Would you know how to get rid of your fear, phobia, stress, or anxiety? How to burst your fear and transform your life? Welcome to Fear Buster Show, presented by Lauren Rosenberg, fear and phobia relief expert and author of How to Move Forward When the Unthinkable Happens. You are listening to UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio with Lauren Rosenberg. www.fear-busters.com.
Hi, welcome back to Fear Buster Show. I'm Lauren Rosenberg, your host, and today we're going to talk about fear, but a special fear that is affecting all of us. I am pretty sure there's not one person that hasn't actually affected. Fear of COVID. COVID-19, this big unexpected pandemic that we have to deal with. How is that affecting you and on your physical and mental health, and what can you do to help? And I have a special guest today, Dr. Sharon Raymond, who's going to talk about all the amazing initiatives that she wants to put in place, or she has to put in place, that is helping, and all the project that you also have. But she's going to talk about it much more than I know. But also, we're going to talk about fear of COVID. How's that affecting you? Not having to go to a supermarket without putting a mask on, or having to follow instructions that are so not natural or normal. What is the norm? Having to adapt and having to learn how to be more resilient. So let's go and see how Dr. Raymond is dealing with COVID. I'm sure there's a... Hi, Dr. Sharon Raymond. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So tell us about the impact on GPs and patients, and what do you think we can do to help, and as a person, and what do you think we should do?
So, wow, that's a very wide question.
I know.
So look, obviously, you know, we're on this journey together with all the highs and the lows in terms of what COVID-19 has been for all of us. I think some people were affected much earlier on with the coronavirus 19. Some people had the condition early on and very tragically and sadly, you know, suffered and perhaps lost loved ones. And it's been an extremely difficult time. So we're dealing not really just with the virus itself, but as you're alluding to, the whole context of how our life has changed and what people keep calling the new normal. We're a bit fed up of hearing the new normal. And it's a different kind of life while we're trying to limit the spread of COVID because of the terrible, complications and results that coronavirus can have.
This new norm, it's sort of, I think it's probably people want to sort of label it something in order to sort of, because we're so used to our normal day-to-day life, and this big thing happened, and suddenly everything that we thought was normal has changed. So I think probably we want to talk we want to name it as this is the norm at the moment. But I think that one of the things that people need to remember is there's going to be an end to it. We're not going to be in it for, we don't know how many years, but there's always an end. And history is showing that pandemic, there's always an end and you always come out. Mm-hmm. There's always some, at the moment, I think probably it's probably helping people to think, okay, this is the norm at the moment, in that sense, probably. What do you think?
I think it's how you view normal and it's how you view day-to-day life. So I think, you know, we've got a certain idea in our heads of what normal should be, but actually now it's a different kind of life. And actually there are some, I won't say necessarily positives, but there are some ways of us, you know, being flexible and changing our way of life so that things can still be livable. And that's a process, you know, change is not a straightforward thing and change takes time. And obviously it depends how resilient and robust we are. And some people, of course, who are isolated, who have experienced, loss as a result of this tragedy, you know, the tragic tragedies in relation to the pandemic, obviously their levels of resilience are going to be lower and it's going to be harder for them to change their way of life. to suit what's happening now. So I think for some people, they don't want to accept that there should be a lockdown. They want to carry on living normally, going out. But
I guess all of us would like to, in an ideal world, there's a lot of things that we would like. But unfortunately, I actually think that one of the thing that COVID is actually teaching us is that we're all in a way the same. We're all in it with the same, and we all have to deal with it. And we should, if we all make some changes all together, we wouldn't be, or I think we wouldn't be in it for too long, but because there's so many different areas. But the thing is, like you said, resilience is, I think it's really important now to teach children tools to be resilient, to be mentally healthy, strong, that whatever happened, whatever the world is sending you, whatever is happening, that you know that you have the tools to deal with your mental health.
Yeah.
And that is probably the future. We need to put some program in place, but not everybody has the tools to be resilient. And when you're talking about people unfortunately passing away, even this, even the funerals are different. I mean, he would have thought that you, I mean, now there's a minimum of 30 people, but there was a time where no one could even get.
Yeah, and it's very tragic.
Being next to the patient at the bedside, that in itself has changed for the nurses, for the GPs, doctors. You don't even have the contact with a family member. So finding out the details of the person or having questions, I mean, everything. There's not one person on this planet who can't say COVID hasn't made me change something.
Yeah, I think COVID has made us see life in a smaller way, in a way. So it's more about whether it's the family unit that we live with or the household, or if we're alone, thinking more about time alone and what we can do in that time because of the isolation, the curfews, the lockdown. And it's kind of pushing, I suppose, many people to look into themselves, to look at other ways of living. People, we hear so much about people, building things, making things, baking. So, trying to cope with this kind of new, there's a lot of silence. You know, we don't have the big rock concerts. We don't have the big gatherings, the big weddings, the big funerals. There's much more aloneness. And for some people, that can be very challenging. So just bringing it a little bit to a focus on kind of healthcare professionals. And there's been quite a lot of talk about the impact on healthcare professionals now coping with this second wave. So, of course, in a time of pandemic, there are different stages in the way that a population, copes with the pressures of a pandemic. In the beginning, you're more enthusiastic, you make plans, you see that you want to help others and so on. But after a while,
and it was a summer. So I think when it was sunshine, you could be in the garden more. It was and the first lockdown, we were all together. There was one rule. No one was going out. And it was new. And like you say, it is something, it was new, but everybody was doing it. Now it's the second one and the winter's coming up.
And I think it's also that uncertainty of not knowing how long it's going to go on for. The clapping has stopped. At the beginning we had the weekly.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So now the clapping has stopped. Everyone has to get on with their work. The risks are still there. The pressures are still there. And it's a sad time. There's a lot of healthcare professionals who have been traumatized by seeing the suffering of others, by their own suffering. We know that BAME in particular, staff have been very profoundly affected by the coronavirus because of the increased kind of vulnerability to this virus. So there have been a lot of personal and collective tragedies. And so with that in mind, I mean, you spoke at the beginning about some of my initiatives. So at the beginning of this pandemic, I was being approached by quite a few colleagues, healthcare professionals, who were telling me that they don't have the protective gear. How can we get it? What can we do? And I did set up a foundation called COVID Crisis Rescue, along with some colleagues. In particular, a gentleman called Alex Adams, who's no longer involved with the foundation, but we kind of initiated this foundation together. And I started distributing in the region of about 60,000 items of PPE to not just within the NHS kind of setting, but also hospices, homeless shelters, women's refuges. And that was certainly very much needed at the time and still needed.
Definitely needed.
And then what I observed also was the need for these oxygen probes, these pulse oximeters.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that and how it could actually help?
So we know that with coronavirus, it can lead to this silent hypoxia. This means a drop in oxygen levels that can happen silently. And what does that mean silently? It means that the patient, the individual themselves that has COVID, whose oxygen levels are falling, may not feel it or realize it themselves. They may just feel very unwell or just very tired. And obviously, they may find that if they're walking just a few steps, they might even feel even more exhausted. But it won't be immediately obvious that their breath is I suppose that's already reaching into the later stages of the evolving of this condition. But before they start to get breathless, their oxygen levels may well be dropping, and it may not be obvious to the clinician, to the doctor or nurse that's assessing them, because they won't come across as, you know, being out of breath or even saying they won't have the sign.
They would just come in and say, "I feel tired," or "I'm just low energy."
And you'll see now that we're doing a lot of these remote consultations. So we, as clinicians, as doctors and nurses and so on, we're assessing patients either over the phone or video consultations because of, you know, this risk of, you know, the more people we bring into the surgery or to A&E, the more people we see face to face, the more there's a risk of spreading COVID. So it's really important to have some kind of tool that helps us to see whether, you know, are the oxygen levels dropping? Doesn't something need to be done urgently or even as an emergency? And so at the height of the pandemic, my foundation, the COVID Crisis Rescue Foundation, we were ordering in many probes, many of these oxygen probes. They're matchbox sized little electronic devices. They clip on your finger and they basically give a reading for how high the oxygen level is in the blood.
Literally easy to use. Yes. Anyone can just put their finger on it, doesn't need to have any knowledge about the numbers or anything.
I'll talk about that in a moment because it's not, you know, obviously it needs to be done with the support and guidance mission, because the patient themselves or the individual may not necessarily know what the numbers mean, what the significance, even because we know now that even a very small drop in the oxygen levels could be significant and may mean that the patient needs to be seen very quickly. So that needs to be done with the support and oversight of a clinician. Can't just be, you know, that patient alone.
Yeah, so I wanted to make sure the listeners know that this is not just
that's an important point. So, and NHS England now is very much coming to support, you know, this remote monitoring, and virtual wards are being set up up and down the country. And this is a directive now from NHS England. But at the height of it, we were receiving many probes that we purchased through the foundation. They were being distributed. And the last delivery was taking a very long time. A lot of products were coming, medical equipment coming from China, as they still are. And there was a huge delay, obviously, because of world demand and limited production and so on. And I realized that I couldn't carry on just giving away the probes, but that there should be some kind of a loaning system. And I came up with the idea of what we now call the Urgent Oximeter Response Service, which is based both at the Royal Free Hospital and Charing Cross Hospital. I collaborated with the Bike Shed community, a team of bikers up and down the country. And we now supply probes when a clinician requests it to patients anywhere in London within a 90-minute time frame.
Oh, wow.
Seven days a week, 12 hours a day.
So how would it work?
It's all based on goodwill. It's all volunteers. We have a hotline. We have volunteer bikers. And this is also for people, for example, who might be homeless, who might be very isolated. They may not have transport to get into a car and go and see their GP or go to what we call a COVID hot hub or go to A&E. And it's not certain that they need to go anyway. So the probe can help in making that diagnostic decision as to whether they do need to be seen by a doctor or not. Go ahead. Sorry, Lauren.
So how would it work, Dr. Raymond? I'm just thinking about people who are on their own, living on their own. They would just, you have a number or they would just ring and this device will be doctored to them, or how would that work?
The request is generated from their clinician. So whether it's a doctor, a nurse, a paramedic, a member of staff at a care home, it needs to be someone clinical.
Okay.
That assess the patient remotely, usually, or may have seen them face to face, but wants them to be monitored on an ongoing basis. Because we know that sometimes people can have a normal oxygen level when they're seen at an appointment, even face to face. And then afterwards, you know, it can sometimes deteriorate. So it's important for people who've got COVID to have this pulse oximeter, this oxygen probe, if their clinician, if their doctor thinks they need it, it's important for them to have it, you know, for ongoing monitoring at home. So the hotline number is accessed by the clinician, and then that triggers the biker to go out and deliver the probe
to
the
patient. So Dr. Raymond, would they have to be diagnosed first, tested positive for COVID?
No, not at all.
No.
There's many patients that we can see from the way they're presenting that they have COVID, and many people, particularly who don't make it to hospital, are not necessarily going to be a confirmed diagnosis of COVID.
So you don't think that if anybody has symptoms, they don't actually need to be tested to confirm it? They just stay at home?
We do want people to be tested.
Oh, you do? Okay.
That's part of it, but that's a separate element. So the testing and then the tracing of people to make sure that it's not spread further, and that people who've been close contacts then self-isolate, obviously is a really critical part of limiting the spread of COVID. We don't want people to go, and that's also part of the logic in having this extra kind of way of monitoring people to see, you know, is there a need, because it helps support that decision as to whether there's a need for the person who's self-isolating with suspected COVID to leave the house. Obviously, if they need to have a test, they will need to leave the house.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily need to be seen in healthcare or have a GP visit or whatever if their oxygen levels are stable. Obviously, it's part of a whole picture.
It's
important just to make the point, not just the oxygen level, it's the whole picture, how that
the whole
patient,
picture, definitely.
Medical problems, et cetera, et cetera. But this just gives us, you know, the oxygen levels give us an extra bit of important information, as does the temperature and so on.
So this device is definitely give you an important information in order for you to decide if that person needs extra help.
It helps having
to go to the hospital.
Yeah, it helps to build a picture of what the level of urgency is. And then once they receive the probe, they should get a call back from their clinician, and they should also be aware of when they need to call for urgent or emergency help based on what their readings are and how they feel in general. I think it's important to say that over this pandemic, people who have developed COVID and others, you know, it is an anxious time. And sometimes that can impact on people's breathing and how they feel in general.
Definitely.
And actually having the probe can sometimes give them that reassurance. Look, my oxygen levels are normal, and maybe it's just because of anxiety rather than. And I'm not saying that has to be, it has to be excluded that there's not something physical going on, but it can be an extra tool in trying to see, you know, is this someone who's what we call worried well, or is this someone who really needs to be seen quickly and there's something kind of, you know, really worrying going on. So it's just, as I say, like an extra tool, and it can help with people whose breathing is affected when they're anxious. But I wouldn't want anyone to think, you know, as a first assumption that it's about anxiety when their breathing is not right. You know, if anyone has breathing that doesn't seem right, they definitely need medical attention.
Yeah, no, of course. And anxiety, it is obviously, as much as it feels real and is scary, it won't affect so much the oxygen level when you use the machine, because obviously that is more
medical.
It's a physical thing.
Obviously, you know, people who are suffering with anxiety or depression will need the support of their GP or other, you know, clinical practitioner that is supporting and helping them, you know, at what is obviously a very difficult time. And just going back to clinicians, and in particular GPs, because it's obviously been a very difficult time for GPs and a time of huge change, because at the outset, We saw that almost overnight, consultations were shifted from being face to face at your GP surgery to suddenly being majority being remote, either by phone or video consultation. And that was a huge change in terms of the IT system and the knowledge and skills of people.
Yeah, no time to get training on this.
Yeah,
same thing for teachers and any professional that had to suddenly switch. But for GPs, if you don't have the contact, and it's quite hard, I presume, because you can miss out on things if you don't actually see the person. So you really got to. So there must be other signs that you need to look at for compared to when you see the person.
It's very difficult in all respects, it's definitely a kind of an art and a skill to assess people when you're not with them in the room, when you're not with the patient in the room. I was going to say that Matt Hancock sort of got his dream because he's very into everything being digital. And that happened obviously very quickly, almost overnight. So there's been a lot of changes for the GP population. I'll come back to your question about the difficulty of assessing people remotely in a moment. And with that in mind, the pressures and also the kind of psychological pressures and emotional and so on that are impacting on the GP population, myself and another colleague, another GP, Dr. Lisa Hertel, we've collaborated with QL, who basically run online counselling and also for specific groups, for some specific profession groups. And what we're hoping to develop, and we're looking for funding, is a pilot project to support GPs online so they can anonymously access counselling with trained counsellors online and with GPs, myself and Dr. Hertel kind of in the background, just looking out for any GP specific issues, because there's issues in relation to employment, in relation to health, et cetera. So,
and stress, the level of stress and expectation also. You're talking about the whole population and suddenly such an enormous amount of people not being well. And there's only X amount of GPs in each country. So this is just like it's more demand than in SM. So I definitely, and I'm sure, wanted to do the best of your job, and the stress, the anxiety, and what they've seen. And it's just not, we didn't expect all this. So I'm also looking into actually setting up more mental health therapy accessible, easy access, and very quick access.
And you were quite right about the children as well, because obviously they haven't reached adulthood yet. They're that much more fragile, vulnerable. And we know that there's been an increase, in mental health issues amongst children and young people and not just adults. So it's, and particularly when we had the lockdown without schooling, it was very, very hard on children and young people.
And the second lockdown at the moment, I find the children are missing on sport activities. They're missing the activity to just moving around and but obviously we're in a pandemic and having a team sport team, you can't really, it's difficult. But so it's any indoor bicycle or something, or kicking a ball in the garden,
we're quarantining or self-isolating. To go out for exercise, and certainly I was very pleased to hear that Joe Wicks, who does all these exercise sessions and talks about the importance of exercise for mental health, has been awarded, I think it's either an OBE or an MBE.
Which
is really well deserved. So it's really important that we think about, particularly those who are working at home, dividing up our day so that it's not one big kind of work event, that we have time for breaks, that we have time for exercise, for lunch and so on, because otherwise some people find themselves, from 8 a.m. in front of the computer and then it's 10 p.m. and the whole day is gone. And I think
it's actually learning about ourselves and learning about how much our body and our mind needs, and sort of putting things in place, mental health, like training your mind, looking at your body. And like you say, it's, if you're staying at home and you're working from home, you just need to sort of adjust and remember that you should stop, have some breaks, go out, go for a walk. And we're very lucky in this country. We still, even if it's lockdown, we can still go for walks.
And turn your times.
And I'm sorry, what did you say? We didn't hear.
I'm saying turn your phone off sometimes. We don't have
exactly.
to be WhatsApp groups and all the virtual.
Exactly. Maybe have a some time, like an hour. If some people are find it really hard to turn their phone off or any device, so but try 20 minutes a day or allocate one half an hour not just being on it, and gradually you can increase it. If it's like a device that needs to be on the whole time and you find it really hard to switch off. But yeah, definitely.
I think also physical boundaries is important as well. So if you're working at home, you have one room, if you've got the space, not everyone has the space, you've got a separate room where you work, then you leave that room to have a break or put away. If you're working in the same place as you're doing other stuff, put away your computer for a while, have a really clear break between, you know, work. And I've certainly had, you know, patients that, you know, I'm looking after who are basically, you know, experiencing those specific issues that they're finding it very hard to make that break from work. And it is getting very stress inducing, and there's you know, quite a lot of anxiety and depression around these situations.
I always guide my clients and tell them to keep a diary, and as much as if you feel really down, just even just one sentence of what are you grateful for, just one sentence, because even you can't even ask five sentences, because sometimes if you're so down you can't even see it. So one sentence. And talking about if you're really stuck in bed and you can't even get out of bed, I don't know if you know, but I always mention juggling therapy. Get some juggling balls and juggles, because it gets you to move your eyes in different direction. And this is one of the cheapest probably therapy in the world. Get some juggling balls, even if you stay in your bed. Just move those eyes, because one of the things that will make you feel more down is having your eyes fixed on a device. Your eyes don't move. Eyes don't move so much. So going, even walking indoor, opening the window, it's really important to also open the window, get some fresh air in that room. There's lots of different things. There's lots of little things that may look like nothing, but if you put everything together, and even if you write one sentence what you're grateful for the day, and you keep telling that sentence and repeat that sentence in your mind, that is the start. You may not see the result straight away, but this is a slow start. And then if you write another new sentence the following day, if you can do two, three, or four more sentences, great. But if you can't, just be kind to yourself. Just write one sentence. At the end of a week, you'll have a few sentences to read. And just even that time of reading, in that time, you're not going to have any negative thoughts. You're going to be feeling more positive, because you're going to read things. You cannot have two emotions at the same time. So if you're grateful, and if you write a sentence of being grateful, you can't be angry and you can't be depressed. You can't be sad at the same time. So this is a way just to start a little bit to go back up. Simple,
very good technique. I think you spoke about juggling. For me, I engage in figurative juggling, not actual physical juggling, because I take on lots of tasks and activities. And I think what's important, if people are able to, is just to keep busy and to have structure to your day. So things that you're doing in your diary, you know, whether it's helping someone else, whether it's work, whether it's a walk, so that gives a lot more structure and kind of shape to your day. Because otherwise, you know, if you are stuck at home, things can get very difficult.
Definitely.
And particularly people losing their job. I came across a very interesting organization called Good Gym as well. And this is a group of volunteers who like to do exercise, and they go and help people out, particularly the elderly. They do everything by foot because they like to have walking and running exercise. I don't know if you've heard of them.
No.
So these kind of initiatives, particularly for people maybe who've lost their job or are waiting to hear, you know, this kind of economic uncertainty and work uncertainty, or that they just want to help others, because that I think is a really good distraction.
Helping houses is one of the things that if you're feeling down, by helping somebody else, by giving and giving your time and helping somebody else, it's actually helping you.
So on Sunday, I had a group of five girls. They volunteered to help come, because I need the probes before they go out to patients. They need to be packed and labels put on them and so on. And they came and packed several hundred probes as volunteers. And then I have very frequent deliveries to the hospitals and so on. And I had yesterday, I had a gentleman who came specially to go and deliver to the Royal Free Hospital, again, a volunteer.
Amazing.
And another lady who went all the way from North London to Shoreditch to go and deliver probes to the bike shed offices there so that the bikers can have. So there's a lot of people who want to help. And I think not only are they doing good, but I think it makes them feel good as well. I certainly feel good, you know, when
I. It does help. You take action and you actually help somebody, and it gets you out of your. Of whatever is going on in your head and whatever situation you're in.
And that is the test now, I think, with coronavirus in some respects. Yeah, giving, because and thinking about the other, because, and that's not always easy to do, because, you know, we accept that some people may have very complex situations and may be dealing with a lot of, you know, physical or mental health issues or family issues and so on. But we spoke about, you know, we've been speaking about the importance of wearing masks, for example, and there was a very poignant kind of a YouTube clip, I think it was, that was put out, I think, by a lady from Hungary. And the message was, I protect you and you protect me. So I think, you know, this is a time where we do need to be thinking, if we're able to, we need to be thinking about our isolated neighbours, the elderly, you know, people who maybe have difficult circumstances, maybe need help with their shopping, maybe need help with delivering their medication or whatever it may be, or are self-isolating or shielding. And that's, I think that's the times that we're living in now, that we need to just see where we can help and how we can help each other.
We're helping us, but we're helping others. And it's really about giving and receiving and knowing that and looking after your neighbor, being aware who needs the help, that and wearing a mask. You're not doing it just because it said so. You're doing it because you're protecting yourself, but you're also protecting somebody else, because part of COVID symptoms is sometimes you can actually, from what I understand, you can carry it without symptoms. So we don't know. So it's important. And I know that some people may find it really hard to wear masks. They can come to me, I can clear the fear. I've done it on air. But it's not, you don't have to wear the mask the whole time, but it's just all keeping the distance. It's all about protection and protecting. It's, we don't know if we're carrying it or not. And it's really protecting the other person. It's not,
if we're able to wear a mask, obviously, as you've kind of alluded to there, some people are not able to wear a mask for medical reasons, and that's obviously, you know, it is what it is. And but for those people who are able to, it's just that kind of message that you may not be protecting yourself, but you will be protecting others in case what's known as a silent spreader, for example. I wanted to just make the point about, because you were talking about the difficulties in assessing, you know, as a GP, assessing people remotely on the phone.
Yes.
Or by video consultation. And I think it's important to note that GP surgeries should all be open. There should be availability of appointments, remote appointments to start with. And we're also seeing patients face to face when we need to. There are a lot of safeguarding issues at the moment. Domestic abuse has gone up, children's safeguarding issues. There are vulnerable adults. And so it can be very hard to make those assessments remotely. And where it is harder, then, you know, we will want to be seeing patients face to face within the surgery, depending on what the medical problem is. If it's a routine problem, obviously not for emergencies. But I think it's important for people to bear that in mind, that it should be business. It's not business as usual, but the surgeries.
Is a way of, if somebody really needs to be seen face to face, they can be seen.
Yes,
it's important for people to know that too.
For, you know, vaccinations, immunizations, and more complex issues that just can't be dealt with on a phone or by video, you know, the GP surgeries are available for that.
Yeah. It's true. And, you know, you're saying a video call, everything's changed so much. I mean, I have two dogs and one of my dog needed a consultation and I was also on Zoom and I was like, okay, it's different.
Woof, woof.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not that easy to hold your dog and show what's wrong with the dog on Zoom. Vet also, they don't let people in. It's all, everything changed. If anyone out there feel isolated and think that it's just about them that things change, it's not. There's not one person that hasn't been affected by the pandemic. Everything's changed, and it's about adjusting, adapting, and really knowing that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. We are going to get there, And in the meantime, we just need to restrict our movement. We need to follow some rules and be much more aware of protecting others and giving. This is the time where if we have free times because we lost our job or whatever situation, and if we're able to help somebody else, this is the time not to just give the time to actually help and volunteers. There are so many different projects out there, and I'm sure you will need more volunteers.
If anyone wants to volunteer for COVID Crisis Rescue Foundation, please make contact. We've got also a Just Giving page because, you know, we need the help and support of the public. Mm-hmm. We're not receiving funding at this point. So, so that would be very much appreciated. And if people want to help in any way, whether it's to deliver probes to the hospital or pack them or whatever it may be, you know, that's absolutely welcomed and very much needed. So,
excellent. And we were just talking about the second pandemic, and people have that specific date in mind, the 2nd of December. But maybe we should be flexible because we don't know if it's going to be the last lockdown or if it's going to be other ones or if the 2nd of December things are going to change. What advice would you say? I mean, it's because people are holding on to that date, like,
yeah. I don't have a crystal ball, and I think throughout this pandemic, in life in general, we know that unexpected things can happen. You know, as they say, you know, man makes plans and God laughs. So, you know, we just need to see how it goes, and I think we need to have that trust that you know, if it's not going to be the 2nd of December, it'll be, you know, a plan based on trying to find the safest and most prudent course of action. So I think there's no kind of hard and fast rules in all of this, and I think the priority is, you know, saving life.
I was going to say exactly, you actually exactly pointed at people sometimes forget because they're looking at their comfort or they're looking at, oh, I don't like wearing masks, or I want to still go out and see my friends. But
it's difficult.
All this is about saving life. It's all about saving life. And that is a message that we need to remember. Mm-hmm. We're all adjusting and changing our behavior for one big reason, is to save life.
Mm-mm. Yeah, but I think coronavirus obviously is one thing, but as we've kind of been discussing now, people's mental health is suffering and also physical health at times. So we know that there have been some diagnoses missed or delayed, you know, treatment and so on as a result of this pandemic. So all these things, all these issues need to be taken into consideration when the government, you know, and NHS and so on consider what the next steps are. So it all needs to be done, as they say, with the advice of the scientists and looking at the facts on the ground. So although we very much hope there's an end very soon in sight, we, I guess, have to just learn to be quite patient and as flexible as we can be, because we know that things can change. We had some great news about the vaccine, and there are some promising, you know, advances going on. So we hope that that this will end soon and won't persist. But I think at the moment we are sort of in the thick of it, and we're trying to slow that progression down. And I think, you know, that's obviously the reason behind the lockdown, and we'll see what happens, you know, at the beginning.
Especially going into the winter yeah. months.
That's well, winter anyway, is obviously a difficult period in general, but this may well make it much harder. But, you know, we can just hope that things will go to plan, but plans don't always happen. So we just have to be patient and get any support that we feel we need, because there's tons of like online support and organizations that will listen and help.
Making that first step. If anyone out there feels they need a support, it's not to think that there's something wrong with them, but it's everyone is suffering in different ways. So making the first step, just even one phone call or telling someone that they feel they need the help or they're not feeling well, if it's physically or mentally, is taking that first step, especially if they're isolated or if they were living on their own.
It's
picking up the phone and making the first contact. So and definitely the device will help, and it's an amazing project. And I hope if anyone is hearing this interview, if they want to volunteer, they'll get in touch with you. But you're doing amazing work, you're making some changes, you're adapting, and it's exactly what you're saying. We just need to remember that not to lose hope, because when there's hope, we can always keep going, and that we're doing everything to save people's life. Mm-mm. That is, yeah. But not to live in fear, not to let COVID win in that sense. Mentally, we need to try to really think of not the fear. We need to, and if we live, some people, if people are really suffering and scared of COVID, take each day as it comes. Just today is today. Don't think of tomorrow. Because if you don't look into the future, you can't be scared so much. Your mind cannot go, if what if and what if and what if.
Just and I think day. The support, yeah, get the support of your GP, get the support of your friends, your neighbors. People want to help right now. There are, you know, lots of people wanting to volunteer within their communities, within their areas, and make sure you get the help that you need and discuss your fears and your worries and how you're feeling, you know, with your GP. Don't just bottle it up. The main thing is to share those feelings, because that's part of the way to managing them.
Definitely. So Dr. Raymond, thank you very much for being part of the show today.
Thank you.
If somebody needs a device, or did you say there is a website, or they need to get, or is it true? I mean, you said it's through the actual...
Yes, it would be through whoever clinician is...
if they want to get in touch with you for volunteering, what's the best way to
We've got a Just Giving page, COVID Crisis Rescue Foundation, or I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn, so I'm very visible. So I'd be very happy if people wanted to make contact, if they want the help, if they want more information, by all means.
Excellent. Dr. Raymond, just to help people who need some help out there, what are the areas or app that you would suggest that you think that could help in different ways?
Yeah. I think the first step is to try and access help from the GP. Obviously, it depends on the level of urgency and the time of day. There's also 111 when your GP surgery is not available. And obviously, if people have any thoughts about harming themselves or any thoughts of suicide, then that would be a call to 999, because obviously that is an emergency. In terms of kind of online support, Mind is very helpful. In some areas, people can get access to Cuth for online counselling. And obviously there's also the Samaritans if people want to talk through things. But what we can do is put together some resources and links that you can put on your on this YouTube clip and share more widely. That's what I would suggest.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
This is Lauren Rosenberg, Fearbuster, and looking forward to talking next week about another fear. Bye.